World Cup Talk. Christina here with the storylines that matter most in football today. Neymar is suddenly the story again, and not for the reason Brazil wanted. The latest reporting around Brazil's opening World Cup draw with Morocco is all about whether he can go in the next match, and that changes the temperature of the tournament immediately. When the biggest star in a group becomes a fitness question before the rhythm of the competition has even settled, every conversation around Brazil gets sharper. It is not just, can Brazil replace him for 90 minutes? It is, what does Brazil look like emotionally and tactically if the game stops revolving around one player who still bends defensive plans just by warming up? What makes this worth your attention is that Brazil did not lose control of the tournament story because of one result. They lost control of the certainty around them. A draw against Morocco is survivable. Doubt around Neymar is more dangerous because it invites everybody else to imagine Brazil as vulnerable, and Morocco are exactly the kind of opponent who thrive when a heavyweight starts looking impatient. Morocco's rise has been built on defensive discipline, quick transitions, and the confidence to make glamorous teams feel uncomfortable. So when the injury talk begins, the match stops being a simple group stage headline and starts feeling like an early referendum on whether Brazil are flexible enough for a modern World Cup. And there is a bigger tournament pattern here. The World Cup is now so physically intense, so compressed, and so globally dissected that every superstar fitness issue becomes a narrative accelerator. Fans are no longer waiting for official squad bulletins. They are monitoring body language, training clips, warm-up footage, and every half-confirmed report that lands in their feed. That pressure is part of the event now. It affects coaches, it affects betting markets, and it absolutely affects how supporters experience the competition in real time. Another thread I think matters today is the fan experience around venues, especially the conversation around MetLife Stadium and, more broadly, what supporters are being asked to pay in money, time, and patience for the privilege of attending. Multiple reports in the last day pushed the idea that some World Cup venues may be spectacular on television while still feeling frustrating on the ground. That gap matters. A tournament is not only judged by the quality of the football, it is judged by how hard it is to get in, get out, find your seat, pay for food, understand transit, and feel that your ticket bought you an occasion rather than a logistical puzzle. This is where the World Cup becomes more than sport. It becomes a test of host city competence and of FIFA's willingness to align spectacle with affordability. If a venue earns a reputation for long travel times, awkward transport connections, premium pricing, or poor matchday flow, that story spreads fast and it sticks. Fans compare notes instantly. One bad experience becomes 10,000 posts, and 10,000 posts become the emotional reality of a tournament city. So even if the football is elite, the memory can still be great match, miserable day. I also want to stay with the money question for a minute, because resale ticket coverage and affordability chatter coming out of Mexico and other host markets point to a familiar World Cup tension. FIFA sells the dream of global access, but the real experience often feels stratified. The best seats disappear early, hotel prices climb, transport costs swell, and then the secondary market turns the whole thing into a contest of financial endurance. For local fans, that can create resentment. For traveling fans, it creates anxiety. And for the tournament itself, it risks making one of the world's most communal sporting events feel increasingly exclusive. That brings me to Guadalajara, which is getting attention not just as a football destination, but as a case study in what host city economics look like when expectation meets reality. The reporting around affordability, visitor experience, and attendance questions may still be evolving, but it speaks to something important. Hosting the World Cup is not automatically the same thing as delivering a smooth fan festival. Cities have to convert global visibility into a workable local experience. If they do that well, the event feels electric. If they do not, the headlines quickly turn from celebration to criticism. And those stories matter because they shape how future fans decide whether going is worth it. On the football side, Canada is another fascinating story today, because some of the most useful coverage is not about one dramatic incident, but about squad depth and tactical identity. That may sound less flashy than injury drama, but it is hugely relevant in a long tournament. Canada are not entering this competition simply hoping to be plucky hosts. The more serious analysis is asking whether they have enough structure, enough midfield control, and enough defensive reliability to turn home soil energy into points. That is exactly the right question. The reason I like this topic for a podcast is that tournament football punishes vague ambition. You cannot just be emotional and brave. You need repeatable patterns. You need to know how you will survive your bad phases in matches. Canada have talent and they have moments of attacking speed, but the World Cup exposes teams that have not decided what they are when the game tilts away from them. So the conversation about managers, shape, squad depth, and tactical balance is not academic. It is the conversation that determines whether a home nation becomes a genuine story or just a loud atmosphere. Then there is Boston, where the first World Cup match at Boston Stadium has added another local layer to the tournament story. These first match moments at host venues are never just about the scoreline. They are stress tests. They tell you how transport works under pressure, whether the venue operations actually match the planning documents, how the crowd behaves in a new World Cup environment, and whether the city can create that feeling fans remember years later. Even when coverage comes through live updates and local media rather than grand analysis pieces, it still matters because first impressions travel fast. I think that is one of the defining themes of this World Cup cycle already. The event is being judged simultaneously at three levels. There is the football level, where injuries, squad choices, and tactical identities shape matches. There is the supporter level, where pricing, noise, comfort, travel, and atmosphere determine whether people feel included in the party. And there is the governance level, where every operational weakness becomes a reputational story about whether the biggest tournament in the sport is being staged in a way that respects fans rather than simply monetizes them. So if you zoom out, today's most interesting World Cup story is not only Neymar's fitness or MetLife's reputation or resale pricing or Canada's tactical profile. It is the collision between elite performance and event experience. The modern World Cup asks players to absorb pressure and asks supporters to absorb cost and complexity, all while presenting itself as a global festival. When that balance slips, people feel it immediately. My watch list from here is pretty clear. First, Brazil's next official signals on Neymar, because that will influence not just one team sheet, but the emotional tone around the tournament favorites. Second, more on venue operations and fan reports from the opening wave of matches, because once patterns emerge, they are hard to reverse. Third, the host nation football questions, especially Canada, because home advantage only matters if it is backed by a real playing identity. And finally, ticketing and affordability, because that story tends to grow, not shrink, once fans start comparing what the World Cup dream actually costs. This is Christina for World Cup Talk. See you tomorrow.